The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 9. Transcription and Translation. The Metaphor of an Error-Prone Medieval Monk in a Scriptorium.
So we left off in the previous lecture with medieval monks laboring in a scriptorium, copying the structure of DNA, copying the A's, C's, G's, and T's into new copies of A's, C's, G's, and T's, and accidentally introducing mistakes or mutations along the way. And that's where we left off. I want to say a little bit more about those mutations, and then I want to take us to the next steps in understanding DNA function. First thing to understand about those mutations that are being introduced is that many of them don't matter. Many of them are not going to substantially change the way the organism reads its DNA and ultimately ends up using the information. So there's a great accumulation of mutations in our DNA that seem to make slight differences between us, but nothing that would make a major difference in the way we carry out our usual biological operations. A few mutations do have negative consequences. A few have positive consequences, but that's where environmental selection comes in. And it's why we had an entire lecture on population genetics. I wanted to let you know just how important it was that all of this is happening within the context of an environment. So to use a really dramatic example, if there were a mutation introduced that caused an embryo not to be able to develop properly in utero, in the uterus, then that animal would never develop and we would never actually see that extremely negative consequence of that particular mutation. So there may be a whole host of mutations that we essentially never get to see. That embryo doesn't get established in the uterus because of the nature of that mutation. But the other thing to remember about this is good enough is good enough. Remember, I did not just call the cookie factory a cookie factory. I called it Rube Goldberg's cookie factory. And I said there's a great deal of redundancy and a great many non-linear pathways and a great many ways to get to the end point, whatever that might be, whether it's making cookies or making pigments in dogs. So the thing to understand about this is there are a great many mutations by which we're still going to get to the same general outcome, that is a functional living organism that's making its way somehow through the environment. Okay, so how is the information in DNA used? It is transcribed, and the image for that is we have our monk who has written out just a short passage from the manuscript onto a temporary scrap of paper and is now running down the hall with that scrap of paper where it will be used in some particular context. Let's not worry about what the context is. Here the metaphor falls apart a bit. But the thing to understand about transcription is that it is a way for the cell to take just a part of the information in the DNA, temporarily record it onto something that is transient, I'm calling it a scrap of paper, and then to go and immediately use that particular set of instructions and then to presumably throw away that scrap of paper and not to have it around anymore. So how might we extrapolate this to the cookie factory? Because maybe this is a good way to try to envision what's going on with the blueprints. Let's say the blueprints for all the parts of the cookie factory are stored in a vault and that we do not need to get all of the blueprints out of the vault every single time we want to make just one little machine. We might just want to copy one part of one blueprint for immediate use, run it down the hall, use it, and then discard it. So temporary copy is what you should be thinking of here. The process in the cell is called transcription. And what happens is the DNA, which is the permanent storage form for the information in the cell, gets transcribed to a short strand of RNA called messenger RNA. That's why I was deliberately using that word messenger, so you can sort of think of someone running down the hall with a little scrap of paper. And that messenger RNA is just one short strand that complements one part of the entire DNA molecule, the part that we're going to use right now. So let's say that our DNA molecule is A, T, G, C, G, A, C, G, etc. That's one of the strands, the strand that we're about to try to transcribe. I'm now going to make a temporary copy, a temporary messenger RNA for that particular strand. And the only big difference is that for reasons that are not well understood by scientists, messenger RNAs never use T, they only use U. U for uracil. So where you should be hearing the letter T, listen for the letter U. Remember, I'm making a complement to the DNA. So it's A, T, G, C. The complement is U, A, C, G. That U is there where a T might have been there. It's one of the characteristics of messenger RNA. So now I've got this little sequence with U's and A's and C's and G's that represents just a tiny part of the DNA, and I'm about to go and do something with it. What I'm going to do with it, once I've run it down the hall, is I'm going to translate it. So first we transcribed a little piece of the DNA. Now we're going to translate a little piece of the DNA. By the way, notice transcription and translation are alphabetical order, and that's another little mnemonic aid I sometimes use with my students. I say, look, transcription, translation, get those words in their correct alphabetical order, and you'll have the order in which these occur in the cell. Translation comes next. I'm going to describe translation to you, but before I do that, let's for the very first time give you a definition of a gene based on the function that we've just described. A gene is that which can be transcribed. It's that which can be copied in the way that I just described on a little piece of messenger RNA and run down the hall for its next function. Okay, so for the very first time in this course, we've defined a gene in a molecular sense, and we've defined it by its function. We've said it's that which can have this particular operation done to it, and that's not all of the DNA. It's only particular parts of the DNA that can be transcribed into messenger RNA and then used in the next way that I'm going to talk about. So let's take that as our baseline definition for a gene right now. So we've got the transcript, we've got the messenger RNA, we've got this temporary bit of information. We are taking it to the next step. It's translation. And here you should think of that word translation just the way we would use it in English. It's as though we were going to translate from one language to another, from German to French, from Chinese to English, whatever the original language is, into a different language. And this requires a fairly elaborate set of cell structures. Elaborate enough that I'm going to walk you through them with the metaphors that we've been using, but it's also well worth having a peek at what a ribosome actually looks like and what transfer RNAs actually look like without just relying on my description of them. So the first thing that happens to that little bit of messenger RNA, that little temporary bit of information that we've just transcribed, is it gets sent like a piece of ticker tape going into a machine that is called the ribosome. It's almost as though you are running this little strip of information through a reader, and the ribosome is ticking it along and reading off A's, C's, U's, remember we're using U's instead of T's, G's, C's, and reading them a little bit at a time. Okay? Also nearby are special additional structures that can read both languages that we're going to need to be able to read. Now, what am I talking about by both languages? Well, we've got DNA language, and we've got the language by which we are going to end up constructing the machines. The machines are made of protein. The machines are enzymes, they're made of amino acids, and we've essentially got to translate this from DNA language to protein language. We've got to translate this from a four-letter code of A, C's, G's, and T's to a 20-letter code of amino acids. It's an absolutely amazing feat. Now, when people were first starting to figure this out, they said, how are we managing to translate from a four-letter alphabet to a 20-letter alphabet to make these complicated enzymes or machines from this relatively simple four-letter alphabet? And they made a bunch of good guesses about it. They said, well, maybe the information is letter by letter, and what we're reading is one letter at a time. In which case, if we've got a four-letter alphabet, we can say four things. Well, four is not enough. Okay, we need to say much more than four things. We have, remember, 20 amino acids that we need to be able to talk about. So four is not enough. Then they said, well, what if these are being read by the pairs? So that if I have a sequence A, T, C, G, first I'm reading A, T, then I'm reading C, G, then I'm reading the next pair, T, T, then I'm reading the next pair, G, G. What if I'm reading these as little two-letter words? How many different possible words could I get out of that? Turns out there are 16. I've got a four-letter alphabet, and I can create all possible two-letter words. I've got 16 different words that I can create out of that. Still not enough. We're trying to make 20 amino acids here, so still not enough. So finally, they tried words of length 3, triplets is what they're sometimes called. And it turns out with a four-letter alphabet, there are 64 different possible triplets that can be made. Now, 64 is way more than 20, but in fact, 64 is the answer. Triplet is the answer to the question. And this was all worked out in the early 1960s. It was an absolutely amazing set of research that put all of this together. What it essentially means is we have a great many synonyms. That is, we have 64 different words in our vocabulary, our DNA vocabulary, and we have 20 different things that we need to say. So plenty of words have synonym-like uses. And four of them are punctuation. Turns out that the triplet combination A-U-G says start here. It's a start. And it turns out that there are three different ways to say stop. U-G-A, U-A-A, and U-A-G. So what a gene actually looks like is it begins with A-U-G. Remember, we're reading this off the messenger RNA, the little temporary bit of RNA. It starts with A-U-G, start. Then we go into a sequence that could be U-U-U, A-C-G, G-G-G. I'm making this up. And then eventually we come to one of the three stops. Let's say it's U-G-A, and we're done. And what we have there in triplets is the code for a set of amino acids that are going to be strung together like stringing together beads. And in fact, at this point, it's almost like instructions for making fancy jewelry when you have a choice of 20 different beads. For example, AAA might say, pick up this bead and string it on. And then CCG might say, pick up this other bead and string it on. So it's essentially the instructions for stringing together 20 different beads of amino acids onto a string that will eventually become a protein. The first of these triplets to be figured out was the triplet that codes for the amino acid phenylalanine. And I wanted to tell you about it because I think it's evocative of the story of how Helen Keller first learned the sign for water from her teacher, Annie Sullivan, a wonderful scene that's been depicted in books and depicted in movies. It was a little bit like that. I mean, imagine trying to figure this out on the molecular level. Just as the first time Helen Keller realized that the tapping of Annie Sullivan's fingers on her palm were the equivalent of water, which is a major translation, right? From water to tapping of fingers on the palm. So too, the scientists made the amazing leap when they realized that UUU means phenylalanine, and they discovered it by artificially making some messenger RNAs that were all U's. They just strung a whole bunch of U's together and they said, okay, what happens here? And what they got was a whole bunch of phenylalanines all struck together. And at that point, they realized they had a chance of breaking the code. All they needed to do was take those one at a time and try to ask what amino acid is being coded for. Because there are so many synonyms in this language, remember there are 64 words and 20 things that we actually need to say, it makes mutations even that less crucial in some cases. That is, in some cases, we'll mutate a gene, but we'll end up getting, nonetheless, a synonym, and we'll end up being able to code for the same thing. So the spelling of some of these triplets really doesn't matter as much as you might think at first because there are so many synonyms. However, there is a type of mutation that can matter a great deal, and it's one that I mentioned previously as one of the possible types of mutations that might be introduced by a medieval monk copying a manuscript, and it could be introduced every time DNA replicates, and that is the type of mutation when either a letter is accidentally inserted or accidentally deleted. And actually, the two types of mutations go hand in hand and sometimes are abbreviated indels for insertions and deletions because sometimes it's difficult to tell whether you've had an insertion or a deletion. Sometimes the effect can be identical. So scientists get around that by saying indels. And the other word that's used for this particular type of mutation is frame shift, which is evocative of what these types of mutations do. Now, let me use an English language example, okay, that will help you to hear and visualize what a frame shift mutation can do. Let's create an English language sentence using just three-letter words, because that's what we're limited to with DNA. So here's our English language sentence. The cat sat. Now, let's have a medieval monk accidentally remove the T of cat. But let's say that we don't read this language especially well. We just know that it gets read by the triplets, that it gets read in three-letter increments. And if I remove the T in cat, I now have T-H-E-C-A-S-A-T and whatever goes next. So I've just done a frame shift. I'm now reading this in a different reading frame, and I'm reading a different set of triplets. Or let's say the medieval monk accidentally adds a letter. So remember, the original sentence is the cat sat, but he adds a B right in front of cat. So now I'm reading triplets like this. T-H-E-B-C-A-T-S-A, T with whatever goes with it. But suddenly that one mutation, whether it's an insertion or a deletion, can have an effect on the entire reading frame of the rest of the strand. So frame shifts actually can have fairly dramatic effects and fairly important effects. By the way, one of the ironies of insertions and deletions or frame shift mutations is that if you get a couple of them, you might end up repairing the frame shift. That is, if I have an insertion followed immediately by a deletion or a deletion followed immediately by insertion, I might actually only render a small part of the text unreadable, and the rest of it turns out to be readable once I've restored the frame in which I'm reading my triplets. So it's one of the ironies that scientists have noticed, that if they have a system that's susceptible to getting insertions and deletions, it can sometimes be not as dramatic as you might think. There are ways of the frame being restored for reading. Now, we just talked about a definition for genes. And let me repeat what that was, because I'm not going to add a little bit of complexity to that. The definition of a gene on the molecular level is that piece of DNA which can be transcribed and then eventually translated and used to make some sort of a protein. Or at least theoretically could be transcribed and translated and made into a protein. We don't actually need to physically see it being transcribed and translated. And there could be some small errors in it such that it might be difficult to transcribe and translate it. But as long as we can see that it was at some point transcribable and translatable, we get to call it a gene. It's a little bit of a controversial nuance. The more genomes are sequenced, the more people go through looking for genes, the more there will be refinements of the definition of genes, and the more people will try to tighten up exactly what we mean when we say this is a gene and this is not a gene and never has been a gene. Now, there's an additional bit of complexity concerning genes, and this is perhaps the place at which to tell you about it. It was a surprise when it was first discovered. It was discovered a few decades ago, and it really put a completely different picture of genes out there compared to what we had thought about genes before this. This is particularly in complex organisms like ourselves, like dogs, like plants, horses. So this is a characteristic of complex organisms. Therefore, it's a characteristic of all the organisms we've talked about so far in this course. And that is, if you actually go into the genome and take a good hard look at that thing that you're calling a gene, you find out that it's got sequences that are non-gene sequences, almost like spacers in between sequences that are gene sequences. So let me walk you through that in a couple of ways, because I want you to be able to visualize it. Let's say that you're looking for a gene and you found one, and you now want to take a closer look to see what it's made of. Well, it's made of coding regions. Those are what will actually end up being translated and used to encode protein. Those are called exons. And it's made up of spacer regions. Those are called introns, followed by another exon, a coding region, followed by another intron, a spacer region, followed by another exon, a coding region, and so on and so on. Now, I'm going to say that again by just saying coding and spacer. I think exon and intron, that's some interesting new vocabulary here, but what we're really talking about is coding, spacer, coding, spacer, coding, spacer. What's going to happen to those spacers? Before we translate, we're going to splice them out. Now, I don't have a good medieval monk story for this, so here's where the metaphor is going to fall apart. But it's almost as if we had the gene sequence all written out in messenger RNA format on a little post-it note, but before we ran that down the hall to get it translated, we cut out some of the sequences that were only in there for filler. Okay, only in there for spacers. Cut them out. And this turns out to have enormous consequences. On one hand, it sounds a little bit inconvenient, doesn't it? It sounds like just an extra bit of business, and why on earth are we doing it? And to tell you the truth, the first time I ever heard of this a few decades ago, that's what went through my mind. It just sounded a little crazy. But what we understand about this system of having coding regions, spacer regions, coding, spacer, which are then spliced together so that we have all coding regions together, is that it allows cells to mix and match their coding regions in a way that I will describe as playful, even though that's, of course, an anthropocentrism. I'm going to call it playful because it reminds me very much of the sort of thing you can do with Lego blocks. If you imagine a set of Lego blocks in a bunch of different colors, sort of like those coding regions. And if you can imagine kids playing with them and saying, well, I've got the red one with the blue one, or I've got the red one with the white one, or I've got two white ones together or two blue ones together. Think of all the different combinations of Legos you might be able to make from several different colors. Those are all the different possible ways that a freshly made messenger RNA can be spliced. That is, the first exon might get spliced with the second exon, or it might get spliced with the third exon, or exon number two might get spliced with exon number three, or exon number one might get spliced with exon number 10. So what those spacer regions do is give us a little bit of flexibility, and it means something absolutely profound. We humans, as well as dogs, as well as all sorts of other animals, only have about 25,000 genes. Only about 25,000 genes, which, by the way, is way less than people originally thought. Before the genome projects came through, people had much higher estimates for that. Yet, we can make hundreds of thousands of potential products. It's a little bit like me saying, oh, look, I'm only giving you 100 different Lego pieces here, and you saying, well, that's okay, I'm still going to make thousands and thousands of different spliced together projects out of this. It's not a problem. So what it means is our capability of coding for things is much greater than a mere 25,000 genes because of this system of coding regions with spacer regions in this whole system of splicing. Now, to put it into a bigger picture here, let's walk through what we've talked about so far in this lecture. I start with a piece of DNA. I transcribe a little piece of it, and by the way, that instantly becomes my definition for a gene. It's that which can be transcribed, a little piece of that DNA. That transcript, that messenger RNA that I just made, has coding regions and spacers, exons and introns, coding regions and spacers. Those get spliced such that the exons are now joined together in various fun combinations, and the introns are all tossed out. They're recycled. Then I run the transcript or the messenger RNA down the hall where it gets translated by the ribosomes and where I ultimately am going to get one of several different choices of protein products out of that one single gene. So it's actually an amazing thing that really, once it was understood, was realized to really revolutionize the way we think about the way genes work. Now, how does the organism control which combinations of exons it's going to put together? That's a whole different topic, and it falls under the rubric of gene regulation, which requires an entire lecture in itself. It's that important, and we'll touch on it just a little bit in that lecture, but I'm also going to say that it's more of the realm of advanced genetics to really understand how these decisions are being made. Suffice it to say, they're important decisions, exactly which exons get put together, and it really adds a really wonderful bit of complexity to a pretty straightforward story, transcription and translation and the making of proteins. So we've been talking about genome projects, and I want to digress a little bit about genome projects at this point and tell you what sorts of exciting things have been revealed by them, and also a little bit about some of the personalities of these genome projects, because there have indeed been some real differences in the way that researchers have gone about them. First of all, before sequencing of genes, which means the reading of the A's and the C's and the G's and the T's in a methodical sort of way, before sequencing became a routine thing to do in the laboratory, people laboriously sequenced just single genes. And it took them weeks to months. It was a major tour de force just to sequence single genes, depending on how far back you go in the history of this. And then people began to sequence tiny viruses. It turns out that viruses have very little DNA, and so if you make it your project to sequence a virus, again, it might take you in the old days weeks to months to maybe even longer, but it's nonetheless a doable project. Then in 1995, there began to be sequenced several small bacterial genomes. In fact, the smallest that people could get their hands on. That was the idea. They wanted to say they had completed a bacterial genome. They certainly weren't going to pick a large bacterial genome because it was still a very laborious project in those days. So several small bacterial genomes were sequenced. Shortly after that, a major bacterial genome was sequenced. It was that of E. coli. E. coli is perhaps the most important laboratory bacterium, the one that we understand best as far as bacterial things go. And this was a major, major accomplishment to finally have the sequences of A's, C's, G's, and T's that give us E. coli. That was a landmark undertaking and probably gave people considerable hope for what came next. What came next, shortly after, was the very first complex cell to be sequenced. Now, again, scientists were very careful as to what they chose. They chose yeast. And think of the very same yeast that you buy in a package at the grocery store. You're buying freeze-dried organisms when you buy a little package of yeast that you use to make bread with. So we're talking about a complex organism, but not that complex. Okay, we're talking about a little single-celled complex organism, and therefore yeast was a good choice for the first foray into complex organisms. Nonetheless, that was a wonderful project, and I think really indicative of the sort of community of yeast researchers that existed then and that still exists, in that they got together to annotate that genome just as soon as they could, and to share information about it because different labs have been working on different genes, and it was a really exciting time for them to put it all together into one picture. I say that in contrast to some other genome projects, okay, that in the case of the yeast genome project, the community around that project was just phenomenal and really was a good model for certain other genome projects to come. In 1998, the first complex organism that was multicellular was sequenced. Now, again, they chose carefully. They chose a tiny, tiny little worm, less than a millimeter long, with only about 1,000 cells. So they didn't want to get too complex there, but that was a major accomplishment to do something that complicated. And that was the little worm called Caenorhabditis. That was in 1998. Now, following that was the Human Genome Project and all that went with it. And again, I'm going to recommend a reading to you. There are many, many complicated political and economical and all sorts of other kinds of things going on with that project. It was not a simple undertaking by any means. And there are wonderful things that you can read to really get a feel for what was going on with that competition. But to make it simple, it was a competition between a commercial enterprise and a government enterprise, essentially government versus private project. And the goal was to complete the human genome in a timely manner and in a cost-effective manner. Then do what with it? And here's where the problems began to come in. People immediately had their eyes on patenting genes or owning genes. And there was a very commonplace mistake that was made in those days, the mistake that I've been warning us against in these lectures, and that is not to say that you have the gene for breast cancer, but rather a gene that is in a pathway for breast development. And there's a difference. As long as you think of it as the gene for breast cancer, then you might well think about it in terms of a gene that you are planning to patent and a gene that you are planning to have some ownership of. So in contrast to some other communities of genome sequencers, this community became a little bit contentious on the subject. Rather than immediately making plans to put all of the new information up into a public database fully annotated, as had the other genome projects thus far, it really has had a struggle to be as nicely annotated and as cooperatively shared as other genome projects. An example of an outstanding genome project, one that I admire greatly, was that for the fruit fly or Drosophila, in which, in contrast to other genome projects that took their time to come up with the complete annotation, they had about 40 scientists get together and over the course of about a week, all together, put together the complete list of genes for the fruit fly. And it's a real amazing example of the kind of community that gathers around a good genome project. Meanwhile, there's more to say on this topic, and I will include additional things about genome projects in subsequent lectures. But what I would like to go on to in the next lecture is something about the structure of chromosomes and why it's important. And chromosome is a new thing in this series of lectures. We haven't really talked about chromosomes yet. So it's at this point, I think, that I'd like to put all of this in terms of the structure of chromosomes and the way chromosomes are used. So that will be the next lecture.
This ends Lecture 9.